Hello, and welcome to Grand Dukes of the West, Episode 25, The League of Jiao. Last time, we saw John the Fearless and his brother-in-law, William, Count of Hainaut, Holland, Zealand, put down a revolt in Liège against William's brother, John of Bavaria, later known as John the Pitiless, for his retributions against the rebels. John had left Paris for Liège at a critical moment. The previous year, he had organized the assassination of his cousin and rival for power, Louis, Duke of Orléans, and was still dealing with the fallout from the murder. So with John absent from the capital, his enemies worked to undermine him. But who were those enemies? Louis of Orléans, of course, tops the list. But he's dead now, so his cause was taken up by his widow, Valentina Visconti. Valentina had spent the past few years exiled from Paris due to her enmity with Queen Isabeau and the rumor that, as an Italian, she had used dark magic to cause King Charles's mental illness. But with her husband dead and their children still children, she was welcomed back to Paris as the leader of the old Orleanist faction. But John's enemies were no longer just the staunch Orleanists. Louis' murder was shocking to the political players in Paris and alienated many who had in the past taken a middle ground between Orléans and Burgundy, or at least were only mildly Orléanist. First and foremost of these was John, Duke of Berry. John was the brother of Duke Philip the Bold, and thus was the uncle of both John the Fearless and Louis of Orléans. When Philip the Bold was alive, John of Berry had often sided with him against the Duke of Orléans in their political squabbles. But with Philip dead, John of Berry began to drift closer to the Orleanist camp. But he still staked out a middle ground, and in the years between Philip's death and Louis's assassination, John worked hard to reconcile the cousins. However, the Duke of Berry was horrified by the assassination, and from then on worked to oppose John the Fearless. John of Berry's position was similar to that of Louis, the Duke of Anjou and sometimes King of Naples, another cousin of John and Louis's, Charles, King of Navarre, son of my favorite medieval chaos agent Charles the Bad, by the way, and many other of the high nobles of France. Unfortunately for those seeking to oppose the Duke of Burgundy, these men were not nearly as ambitious, decisive, or strong-minded as the Duke of Orléans had been or the Duke of Burgundy was. Therefore, the political resistance to John the Fearless was weak and disunited in the immediate aftermath of Louis's assassination. Another important rival of John the Fearless was the Queen, Isabeau of Bavaria. Like John of Berry, she had generally sided with Philip the Bold while he was alive, before switching sides to ally with Louis of Orléans. However, Isabeau always put her own interests and those of her children first, and so throughout the later years of Philip's life, staked out a middle ground and acted as a mediator to maintain order in the kingdom. But after Philip died, Isabeau then saw her interests best served by working with the Duke of Orléans. I don't consider her an Orléanist, but she did tend to work closer with the Duke than the other high nobles did. After Orléans' assassination, she saw John the Fearless as the greatest threat to her position as guardian of her children, and so worked to organize a party of her own to protect that position. This party had two main players, John V, Duke of Brittany, and Jean de Montagu, a powerful royal official. We explored why both of these men had reasons to oppose John the Fearless in episode 23, so I'll just briefly reiterate that the Duke of Burgundy had aligned himself with John V's enemies in Brittany, and that Jean de Montagu had a strong ideological opposition to the Duke of Burgundy, and as a former marmoset, was already predisposed to taking an anti-Burgundian position. Where was King Charles of France in all this? Well, he was barely a player. Throughout the 1400s, the king's mental illness had grown steadily worse. He was often totally incoherent. These episodes were diplomatically known as his absences, and even when he was sane, he was tired, his memory was foggy at best, and he was paranoid and easily manipulated. Royal authority now largely lay with the Dauphin, or Crown Prince, Louis, Duke of Guienne, an 11-year-old who happened to be married to a daughter of John the Fearless. So in 1408, there was opposition to the Duke of Burgundy, but it was not a single bloc. The Orleanist faction, led by Valentina Visconti, the Ducal faction, led by John of Berry, and the Queen's faction, led by Isabeau, all sought slightly different outcomes to the crisis that John the Fearless sparked when he killed his cousin, and wanted to pursue slightly different paths to those outcomes. Still though, these factions were starting to work together, and were beginning to unify. Before John the Fearless left Paris in the summer of 1408, both Queen Isabeau and Valentina Visconti had left the capital with their eldest sons, the Dauphin and the Duke of Orléans, respectively. The Queen returned to her castle at Milan, where she set up a court in exile. She had left with the Dauphin shortly after the justification was presented to the court, in hopes of preventing the Duke of Burgundy from further using her son as a pawn, or even removing him from her care. The Duke of Berry and many of the important royal office holders had joined her there, as did the King in late June. At Milan, they held a meeting of the Royal Council, where the King, apparently cogent again, cancelled his earlier pardon of the Duke of Burgundy, days before John left for Liège. Shortly after the Duke of Burgundy left Paris, King Charles returned to his capital, but the Queen and the Dowager Duchess of Orléans would not return for over a month. They needed time to stack the deck in their favor. Despite the court turning on him, John the Fearless was still immensely popular with the people of Paris, and who knows how they might respond to an attack on him. In late August, the Duke of Brittany had finally arrived at Milan with a company of soldiers, and then he, the Queen, the Dauphin, the Duke of Berry with another small company, and the Constable of France with a company of his own, all began the journey back to the capital. The mood in the streets was not hostile to the returning royals. In fact, if anything, it was jubilant. Most of the unpopularity of the administration had been focused on Louis of Orléans specifically. And while the Queen herself wasn't especially popular, the people of Paris were eager to welcome back the Dauphin. The entrance back into Paris resembled a joyous entry. The Dauphin led the way, riding on a white horse, while the Queen and the accompanying nobles followed through the streets in gilded carriages. But alongside them were the soldiers of Brittany, Berry, and the Constable, carrying banners with the imposing slogan, "Think what you like." A few days later, Valentina Visconti, her son, the Duke of Orléans, and the new Duchess of Orléans and former Queen of England, Isabella of France, had their own entrance. This entry was not quite as joyous as the Queen's and Dauphin's was. This one had a vibe much more like a funeral procession. The carriages were black and drawn by black horses, and they were all dressed in black as well. About a week after the Orléanist return to Paris, another session of the Great Council was summoned, which resembled the one held by John the Fearless in March. The magnates of France, other than John the Fearless, of course, were all in attendance, as were the bishops of France and the royal officers. And this council was why it was so important that the Dauphin returned to Paris, for if Charles were to fall insane again, the prince would have to oversee the proceedings. This council was essentially the opposite of John's. An Orléanist theologian now began refuting Jean Petit's justification and then countered with accusations against the Duke of Burgundy. I won't go into the same level of detail as I did for the justification, but if you are interested, Enguerrand de Monstrelet also recorded it in his chronicles. Once that was done, an Orléanist lawyer followed with a list of demands of punishment. These included, but were not limited to, having John publicly ask for a new pardon from the king, and then ask for a pardon from Valentina Visconti and the young Duke of Orléans, the destruction of all of John's property in Paris, having the Duke of Burgundy build a chapel on the site of the murder and fund masses for Louis of Orléans' soul, with additional chapels built in Orléans, Rome, and Jerusalem, that a fine of 1,000,000 francs be imposed on John, and finally, that all of John's lands be confiscated, and that John be imprisoned until the fine was paid and all the chapels and other monuments were built. Richard Vaughan wrote about it that, quote, "The marathon expiation required was vindictive and humiliating in the extreme, though characteristic of the mental or moral savagery of the age." Now obviously, John would never allow this punishment to be metered out, and would fight until the end to preserve his position and the power that his father had worked for. And so when he won at OT about 2 weeks after this council took place, his mind no doubt returned to Parisian affairs. And unfortunately for the anti-Burgundians, this sentence was about all they accomplished while John was away from Paris. Returning to Richard Vaughan now, quote, "At first it seemed like the French princes and government might seize this opportunity to act against him, to exclude him altogether from Paris, or even to invade and confiscate his French possessions. No such course of action was even contemplated. There is no one in Paris strong enough to master events in this way. Apart from drafting royal letters on the 2nd of July, 1408, and revoking the letters of pardon issued for John on the previous 9th of March, the assembly of some troops, and the above-mentioned formal denunciation of John on the 11th of September, nothing was done. no difficulties were placed in the way of the victor of OT. John's victory at OT had an electric effect on the people of the capital. There had been some discontent after the September sentence, and Burgundian partisans gave fiery speeches to rile up the city. Fearing a revolt, the queen moved to secure Paris against both the people and John. More soldiers were summoned to the capital, and instructions were given to the cities of northern France not to admit the Duke of Burgundy if he appeared outside their gates. The people of Paris traditionally had the right to hang up chains at certain locations across the streets, which could prevent an army from marching through them easily, similar to the barricades of the 19th century French revolutions. And hoping to get ahead of a wave of popular discontent, the queen ordered these to be removed. However, this order almost sparked a riot of its own, and so Isabeau had to back down. Furthermore, Paris was put in a state of lockdown. People were prevented from entering the city without passes, face coverings were banned, and anti-Burgundian soldiers constantly patrolled the streets. When John returned to Flanders after OT, he was greeted with a message from the court, which prohibited him from bringing an army to Paris. But emboldened by his victory, John reportedly replied that he would bring as many soldiers with him as he saw fit. So before John could begin his return march back to Paris, the queen, the dauphin, and much of the rest of the court fled the capital once more, fearful of a Burgundian army and the Parisian mob, and headed to Tours. This flight was done in secret to prevent interference from the populace and to prevent John from getting notice. The Duke of Burgundy returned to Paris at the beginning of winter, accompanied by an army 20,000 strong. But with the court no longer in the capital, there was little that he could do. John knew that he had to come to an agreement with the court if he was going to effectively wield power again, and luckily for him, one of his staunchest opponents, Valentino Visconti, died in early December, making some sort of reconciliation much more possible. The leader of the Orleanist cause was now the young Charles, Duke of Orléans, who at 14 was legally an adult, but one with very little experience and force of will. Despite the harsh sentence that John faced, most of the members of the court believed that a reconciliation was still possible if John were to publicly seek a pardon and spend a few years away from court. However, John could not abide by even that, as he still stood by the arguments made in the justification, and could not make an about-face without losing some of his popular support. Moreover, his banishment from court would essentially remove any influence he had over the royal government. So for John the Fearless, even this relatively minor compromise would be too much. But even with John's obstinate position, the negotiations for a settlement continued. These were facilitated by William of Bavaria, Count of Hainaut, Holland, and Zealand. William was not only John's brother-in-law and partner in Low Country affairs, but he was also a cousin of the queen and had recently wed his daughter Jacqueline to a younger son of the king and queen. However, Jean de Montague also took part in these negotiations, which might have ended up drawing them out a bit due to Burgundy's deep hatred of Montague, which was fully reciprocated. The first few weeks of 1409 were thus taken up with a combination of negotiation and troop movements. By the end of January, an agreement was reached where John would withdraw his soldiers from Paris and take part in a ceremony of reconciliation. And in March, John finally appeared before the king at the Cathedral of Chartres. Importantly for John the Fearless, this reconciliation would not force him to apologize for the murder of Louis, pay reparations to his family, or leave Paris. John's only statement of regret was that his deed had caused the king distress, and he proclaimed that he intended to serve Charles loyally. Charles then pardoned John once again, and the young Duke of Orléans and his brother, who stood near their father's killer silently weeping throughout the ceremony, assented. Jean de Montague then presented the Duke of Burgundy with a peace deal, and on the surface, everything could now go back to normal. But the Pandora's box had been flung open, and the ceremony could only paper over the discontent. John the Fearless had won this round. Jonathan Sumption wrote, quote, "He had accepted no punishment for his crime. He had conceded nothing. John declared that his satisfaction was shared by everyone else in the cathedral, but he can hardly have believed this himself. The peace was a travesty. It had been imposed on the king's weak, divided, and frightened counselors, and they in turn had imposed it on the young princes of the House of Orléans. The discontent was audible in the cathedral." More than anything else, the ceremony was a humiliation to the Duke of Orléans and his brothers. While it was unlikely that the bad blood between Orléans and Burgundy would ever be resolved, The reconciliation at Shott reinforced and reaffirmed the deep hatred these teenage boys had for John the Fearless. John might have been able to avert the coming years of conflict if he had been willing to accept the slap on the wrist of apology and temporary banishment from Paris. But his pride and lust for power prevented this and galvanized his opposition. While the sons of Louis and Orléans and their allies were in no position to threaten him now, they were still dangerous. After the reconciliation, John returned to Paris, and he welcomed back the king, queen, and dauphin a few weeks later. Once more, the capital was in a jubilant mood to welcome back the royal family. But despite the return of the court to Paris, John still did not have complete control over it. Still, though, he wielded far more influence now than in the winter of 1408-1409. The royal council was still filled with Orleanist partisans, and even those not formerly directly connected to the Duke of Orléans tended to view John in a negative light. Isabeau, despite an earlier promise that she would make the other royal dukes appear at meetings of the royal council, repeated her now often used strategy of leaving Paris for Milan with the Dauphin in order to prevent the Duke of Burgundy from using him as a political pawn and font of legitimacy. John did manage to win over the King of Navarre to his side, and he was a valuable ally to have. Perhaps John's greatest victory in the months after Shott was the imprisonment and execution of Jean de Montague in October. Montague was charged with corruption and plotting with Louis of Orléans to extend the king's illness. The Duke of Berry and the Queen lobbied on the royal official's behalf, but there was little that they could do. John was able to kill another of his bitter enemies, and from there he began a purge of the administration. Montague's execution cowed many of John's opponents in that administration, and those that still resisted were now dismissed and replaced with Burgundians. The Chambre des Comptes, the royal household, and the royal council were all shuffled about, with John's enemies being arrested or fleeing the capital. John could now effectively pull the strings of the royal administration. The king, but really the Duke of Burgundy, used the Burgundian program of reform to further attack the Orleanists. Grants from the royal domain were rescinded, and salaries were cancelled. However, this did not extend to the Duke of Burgundy or the King of Navarre, who now had access to royal largesse once again. By the end of 1409, the queen had to accept that John was triumphant. A treaty was drawn up between Isabeau, her brother Louis of Bavaria, the Duke of Burgundy, and John's allies, which opened the flow of the royal treasury to the queen in exchange for the queen handing over her guardianship of the Dauphin to John. Tracy Adams writes, quote, "Isabeau's decision has been variously viewed, with some seeing it as motivated by fear. I believe that this is true, but that the assessment must be nuanced. Undoubtedly, she regarded the Duke of Burgundy with apprehension, but Isabeau's move seemed strategic, a decision to co-opt rather than resist him, a decision forced on her, but one through which she nonetheless attempted to exercise dominion. It is important to realize that she did not relinquish control over her son, for decisions made by John regarding the guardianship were subject to her approval and the king's. She further guaranteed that the Dauphin would feel her influence by seeing to it that her brother, Louis of Bavaria, held a position within the boy's entourage." John the Fearless now controlled not only the royal governing apparatus, but also the person of the Dauphin. And towards the end of 1409, with the Dauphin's 13th birthday approaching, meaning that he would soon reach the age of majority, King Charles began delegating more and more powers to his son. Furthermore, once legally an adult, Dauphin Louis would require his own household, which John made sure to fill up with Burgundians. With these tools, he was undeniably the master of France. However, while John did have access to the French treasury, it appears that he could not dispense with money as he pleased. Only in 1410 does his access to royal funds approach that of his father, and even then, these payments are all for specific expenses, mostly military, rather than gifts to Burgundy. Possibly, this was due in part to John's reforming tendencies, but more likely, he still faced resistance from the officials in charge. Still though, he did manage to get the crown to largely pay for his civil wars, and that's not nothing. Essentially, John got the French treasury to finance his dominance in France, but he did not otherwise profit financially from it as Philip the Bold did. As John grew more powerful, he alienated more of the princes, and as 1409 ticked over to 1410, these princes were finally able to unite and take action. Jonathan Sumption writes, quote, "John the Fearless had obtained effective control of the state, but it had cost him the acquiescence of the princes. It began to dawn on these men that the Burgundian reform program would deprive them of the easy access to royal funds that they had enjoyed for years, and that John and his intimates were likely to be the only gainers. The shock of Jean de Montague's brutal end still reverberated. The great minister had been little loved, but he had for years eased the passage of royal revenues into the coffers of the princes, and they had repaid his complaisance by protecting him against his many enemies. They had not been consulted before his arrest, and their protests at his destruction had been brushed aside. So the beginning of 1410 saw many of the high nobles of the realm leaving court as they no longer had any say in it. The Dukes of Berry and Bourbon had even stopped being summoned to the meetings of the royal council due to their opposition to the Burgundian program. And into this pool of discontent stepped Charles, Duke of Orléans. In the years since the so-called reconciliation of Chartres, Duke Charles had been nursing his grudge against the Duke of Burgundy and building up his support. And as John alienated these powerful lords, they saw the solution to their exclusion in the Duke of Orléans. In April of 1410, the Duke of Berry presided over a meeting with the Dukes of Orléans and Brittany, the Counts of Alençon, Armagnac, and Clermont, the Constable of France, and the brothers of Jean de Montague in the town of Gien. These men had been in talks for a while with their goal of removing the Duke of Burgundy from power. John of Berry and some of the more moderate lords wanted to do this by appealing to the king, but the more radical and militant faction won out. And so on April the 15th, the lords signed a military alliance to raise an army of 9,000 men and formed the League of Jean. This alliance was reaffirmed a few days later when the now widowed Charles of Orléans married the daughter of the Count of Armagnac. And so the League of Jean would soon evolve into the Armagnac faction. The League of Jean was not a monolith, and the level of commitment of the various members ranged from diehard to barely enthusiastic, but it still represented a significant threat to the Duke of Burgundy. John, for his part, saw the threat that the League posed and soon sent envoys of his own to his allies in the Low Countries, the Duke of Brabant, the Counts of Hainaut, Holland, Zeeland, Namur, and Cleves, and the Bishop of Liège, telling them to begin mobilizing their troops. Upon seeing these armies form, the people of France at first thought that an English invasion was on its way, but that is a threat for another day. The members of the League of Jean then returned to their own domains to make preparations for the coming conflict before meeting up again in Poitiers in July. However, the Leaguers were not the only ones on the move. John the Fearless now controlled 9,000 men of his own in and around Paris, and had managed to resolve his conflict with John V, Duke of Brittany. Therefore, the Duke of Brittany, one of the most militarily powerful members of the League, was notably absent from Poitiers. John V's absence and John the Fearless's preparations meant that the other members of the League of Jean now had to summon reinforcements to stack the odds. Throughout this period, King Charles had been sending messages, envoys, and orders demanding that the League stand down, but their response was always the same. They would not do so until the king had received them and they could make their case to him, something which the Duke of Burgundy was sure to prevent. By the end of August, the League of Jean had moved with their soldiers to Tours before marching to Chartres, less than 60 miles from the capital. The recent death of the Duke of Bourbon meant that the new duke, the former Count of Clermont, now had more resources to draw from, and the Leaguers were also joined at Chartres by the Constable. While the forces of the League of Jean grew, so did those controlled by the Duke of Burgundy. Furthermore, John was still popular amongst the people of Paris, who were willing to defend their city against the League army. The Duke of Burgundy was also able to exploit the king to gain further support. King Charles had been sane for the past 2 months, and while he may not have had a full grasp on the situation, he was able to see that many of the lords of France were marching on Paris and ignoring his orders to stand down. Furious at the contempt for his royal dignity, Charles summoned the Oriflamme and announced that he would lead the defense of Paris in person against the League. However, Charles would not end up taking the field, and while the areas around Paris did see some skirmishes between Burgundian and Leaguer soldiers, no large battle would occur. The lords of the League knew that they did not have enough men to take Paris, and John knew that he could not hope to govern France over the objections of the League or defeat the League in a cold war. The King of Navarre put forward a compromise. Both parties would return to their lands, disband their soldiers, and give up the salaries they drew from the treasury. A non-aggression pact until Easter 1412 would be made, and a new non-partisan royal council would be appointed. At first, the members of the League were intent on pressing on, but John's military position was excellent, and he had firmly garrisoned the area around Paris. To make matters worse, the League army was beginning to run out of supplies. And the Duke of Burgundy was facing many of the same problems. Due to all the soldiers roaming throughout the Ile-de-France, both Leaguer and Burgundian, many people had sought shelter in the capital, stretching the city's resources. And both the League and the Duke of Burgundy were beginning to run out of money to pay their troops. The situation really reminds me of the 1405 confrontation between Louis of Orléans and John the Fearless, which I covered in episode 22. So in early November, the terms put forward by the King of Navarre were agreed to with a few additions at the Duke of Berry's castle at Bisseut. This could not be considered a victory for the Duke of Burgundy, but neither was it a defeat. John did manage to secure a small victory in the days after the deal was made, when he managed to detach the Duke of Berry from the League of Jean. John of Berry had never been over-eager for a military confrontation, and wanted, above all else, to regain his old influence over the government, and he had little interest in forcing John the Fearless to repent for the murder of the Duke of Orléans. The Duke of Burgundy agreed to share the guardianship of the Dauphin with his uncle, and to support the interests of the elder Duke and ensure that he once more had a say in Paris. But while the Duke of Berry now made moves to dissolve the League of Jean, as he had gotten what he wanted from it, namely his return to government, the League was not purely the child of Berry. The other members of the League had their own reasons to oppose Burgundy, namely to avenge Louis of Orléans, and that deed was still undone. As the peace between Berry and Burgundy was signed, the king once more became absent, and the government now fell to the Dauphin at the nonpartisan Royal Council. However, this council was still majority Burgundian, even if the balance of power was now much closer to even, and the Burgundians still controlled many of the other arms of the royal government and the Dauphin's household. John the Fearless may have left Paris, but he still controlled the city. The remaining members of the League of Joux were not happy with how their initial confrontation played out, and were already planning a return to arms. Thank you so much to my patrons: Uldis, Duke de Chimay, Christine, Comte de Chenonceau, Elliot, Graf von Kravenstein, Anthony, Comte de Chateauneuf-en-Auxois, James, Graf von Temsa, Preston, Comte de Saint-Fargeau, Nicholas, Comte de Comarin, Mark, Comte de Mirceau, and Diana, Graf von Biersel, and thank you to my Knights of the Duchy. If you want to join them, you can at patreon.com/valoisburgundy. If you want to support the show in other ways, you can by leaving a review on your podcast app of choice and telling your friends about it. Both really help to grow the show and will earn you my everlasting appreciation. If you want to keep up with the show, you can follow me at ValoisBurgundy on Twitter, and now on Blue Sky as well, or find Grand Dukes of the West on Facebook. You can also email me at granddukesofthewest@gmail.com, and check out the podcast website for maps, images, sources, and more at granddukesofthewest.com. Once again, thank you for listening.